All right, we're beginning here on the bottom of Nun Bet, Amud Bet, three lines from the bottom. Rav Papa, Yasik Le Debrei, Be Abasura. Rav Papa was writing a shidduch for his son. Be Abasura is actually his father-in-law's house. I just saw that earlier in the Gemara was talking about the experiences of women in their first time of Biyah. And over there, it quoted Rav Papa speaking about Bat Abasura, the daughter of Abasura, meaning that Abasura was his father-in-law. So he's going over there to find a wife, suitable wife for his son. What's interesting here is Rashi says, Chamivaya, he was his father-in-law, we see Rapapa leave no, and Rapapa married for his son, Achotishto, the sister of his wife. Rapapa's wife's sister is who he married to his son. Abamari was Rapapa's son, which is extremely problematic because that would make her his aunt. And so how is it possible that he did this? One of two possibilities. One is that Rav Papa actually had two wives. And Rav Papa's son that he was marrying off over here was born to another wife, not the daughter of Abasura. Therefore, his son has no relationship to this aunt, quote-unquote, his sister-in-law, because he was born from another mother. That's one possibility. The other possibility, although it would still possibly be a Shniel de Arayot, is that Abasura's daughters were born from common mother and not a common father. But even there, on a first generation level, it's usually a Shreyot. It's not so clear here how they did it, except for the fact, the possibility that Rav Papa had this son from a different wife. Azal, the Michtav Lak Tubata. So they went ahead, they wanted to write the Ktubah. Unlike today, where you have a pre-printed document and you just fill out the names, over there, when they're writing the ktubah, this was a negotiation. The negotiation about the dowry, negotiation about the tosefet ktubah, this was all going on, and then they would document that in the ktubah. Shama Yehuda Bar Mereimar. So Yehuda Bar Mereimar heard that Rav Papa was coming to town. Nafak Ata Itchazile. So he went out, he greeted him, he saw him. Kimato lepitcho, when they reached the house of Abba Sura, when they reached the door, Havakam Miftar Minei, Yehuda Bar Mereimar wanted to take leave of Rav Papa, and that was his visit. He had enough. He didn't want to be involved in this negotiation. Amar le Neomar Bahadai. So Rav Papa encourages Yehuda Bar Mereimar, why don't you come in with me? Chazi Adulav Nechle. He saw that he was uncomfortable about going into the house with him. Amar le Madatech. Why are you uncomfortable? Rav Papa says to Yehuda Bar Mereimar, why are you uncomfortable about entering with me? Mishum de Amar le Shmuel de Rav Yehuda, because you know this memra that Shmuel says to Rav Yehuda, Shinana, either sharp one, or it could be a description of Yehuda, which is Rav Yehuda Shinana, Rav Yehuda the long tooth one. Lo de'ave bavure achsanta afilu mi bara bisha de bara tava. Person should not be involved in moving Yerusha, even from a bad child to a good child. I mean, you have one child who's learning Torah, Shomer Torah Mitzvot, and another child who's not. You shouldn't be playing around with Yerusha in order to favor the child that is on the Derech HaYashar. Delo yedia, maizara nofek minei. Because you have no idea what's going to come out of him. This is the same story that we have by Chizkiyahu Melech. The Gemara talks about the fact that Yishayahu came to him and asked him, why aren't you procreating? Why aren't you involved in Pru Urvu? And he says, like, I know what type of son is going to come out of me. I see in the future. My son's going to be a Rasha Gamor. So I didn't want to have this child. And Yishayahu Navi says to him, V'hadei kavshed rachman alomloch. What are you getting involved in God's issues? That's not your issue. Your din or your mitzvah is to have Pru Urvu, is to have children. You have no idea, first of all, this child, who will come from this child. So you don't have a right to make that decision. And number two is, you have to do your best. And then the rest is Hashem's, in a sense, responsibility. So the same thing over here. You can't play around with the Yerusha because you have no idea, the grandchildren or great-grandchildren, you don't know where this is going to end up. So you shouldn't play around with the Yerusha because you think you're doing the right thing. In the end, you might end up doing the wrong thing. And certainly from a son to a daughter, which he viewed the giving of a dowry to a daughter as being Mavir Yerusha from the sons. The sons were entitled to the estate. And here where the father gives dowry to his daughter, he's basically taking what would have gone to the sons out of the estate and now giving it to his daughter. So he didn't want to be involved in such a process. He didn't want to be involved in giving of the dowry. So hai nami, takanta d'rabbonani. He says that the dowry and the giving of the dowry and the encouragement to give larger dowries is a takana d'rabbanan, which we saw yesterday. Damar Rabbi Yochanan mishim Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. That was the beginning of our Gemara. After the Mishnah, it says, Damar Rabbi Yochanan mishim Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai mipnei ma'it kinuk tuvat benin dichrin. Why did they establish tuvat benin dichrin? K'dei shikpots adam yichtov libito kivno. In order to encourage or facilitate the giving of larger dowries, so that a person will give as much to his daughter as he gives to his son. So we saw that in yesterday's daf, that there's such a takana. Nevertheless, he was not so inclined to enter with Rav Papa. Amarle, hane mile midate. That's only if he does it willingly. Lasuye inami. Says, who says to put pressure on him? Again, this is get mi'useh. Who says here that the Chachamim, when they said they instituted this takana, that's when the father of this daughter gives a dowry willingly. He gives it to her in order to encourage the marriage. It's not here where you're already agreeing that these two parties are going to get married, and then now you're coming to find out how much of a dowry he's going to give, so you're pressuring him to give more in order to make this a better, quote-unquote, marriage. Who said, I didn't ask you to come in and put pressure on him. I said, just come in and don't put pressure on him. Just sit with me there. I don't want you to necessarily say anything or put any pressure on Abba Surah. So Amalei, Yehuda ben Reimer understands already. He says, Malai didi, hainu asya. He says that my entering is the equivalent of pressure. I'm a person of stature. I'm someone who the individual will feel, wow, if this person is friendly with Rav Papa or this person is together with Rav Papa, then he must be a distinguished individual. If that's the case, I have to give a larger dowry in order to match up to the stature of what the individual or who my daughter is marrying. Because of that, he feels like my presence is a pressure by itself. Achve v'o, Rav Papa achve. So we saw this before. Achve means that he forced him. We saw before that Tosfot said before, when the Gemara said that we are kofin in this way, we said that kofin bitvarim. Kofin was verbal pressure. Over here, this is one of the proofs for Tosafot, the fact that the word kfiya does not always mean physical kfiya. It's clear here that he didn't physically force Yehuda by Mareimar to enter. And as Rashi says over here, Achfiye Rabbi Papa Yehuda bidvarim. He did it through verbal pressure. He coaxed him to come in with him. So this is one of the proofs that Tosafot brought before when we were talking about Achfiye, that Achfiye is not necessarily with Malkot, but bidvarim, with verbal pressure. Ishtik v'yotiv. He was silent and sat down. He said nothing. So that was almost counterproductive in terms of Yehuda ben Reimer's perspective. From a puppet, it worked out perfectly, which is, Savar ha'u mirtach rotach. Abba Surah thought the reason that Yehuda ben Reimer was silent was because he was so angry about the dowry, that it wasn't enough, that he couldn't believe how little he was giving. And so he thought he was burning up inside, and I couldn't say anything. He wrote everything that he owned, he gave to his daughter as a dowry, because he felt this pressure to give more, because Yehuda ben Reimer has never said anything, like Mazel Tov, oh great, he never said a word, and so he thinks he's never satisfied with it. The Sof, at this point, you're still not satisfied, because Yehuda ben Reimer still didn't say a word. I didn't leave a single penny for myself. I give everything to my daughter. How could you not be satisfied? So now finally, Rehuda ben Reimer speaks up. He says, had you asked me, had you taken counsel with me, I would have told you that you didn't have to give anything. I don't think you should write a dowry at all. So this is according to how Rav Papa had spoken to him before, which is Rehuda ben Reimer is of this belief that giving of a dowry is completely improper. That's being mavir yerusha from a son to a daughter. And therefore, the dowry is completely improper and you shouldn't have given a penny. Instead of you being penniless and giving everything, you should have given nothing. So Abba Surah says, well, now that I know all this information, I want to back out of the commitment that I made. I offered all of this in the dowry. Now I want to back out of it. Amalei, Shavya Nafshecha, Hadrana, Lokamina. I didn't say that you should be called a reneger. You can't just walk out of deals. You made a commitment. You can't walk away from your commitment. So basically, Yehuda Bar Meimar says, you're stuck now. I don't think you have to give this, but if you have already given your word is important, and you can't just walk away. And you see the idea of speaking the truth, and when one gives their word, that we don't back out. They didn't contract yet. As Tosafot points out over here, Afagav de'inein dvarim niknim be'amira, even though these types of negotiations turn out to be things that are koneh be'amira, through simple verbal exchange, normally you have a contract. That's what creates the commitments between the parties. So in halacha, you need a kinyan, you need something that formalizes the transaction or documents the transaction in a way that is obligating of parties. So in halacha, we use something called a kinyan. In modern law, they use something called consideration. Every contract involves a certain amount of consideration on the other part, which is an indication of the commitments of the parties in the document. The exception to that rule is marriage, which is by marriage, the kiddushin themselves generate the kinyan effectiveness for the negotiations that surrounded the marriage. Which means that if they negotiated verbally about what the commitments were of the two parties, then they have kiddushin. The kiddushin itself formalizes all of those verbal agreements, even though there was no kinyan directly about those agreements. In modern law, there is a similar idea that marriage overcomes the need for consideration in a contract, that the marriage itself can generate obligations on both parties' parts without the normal formalities of a kinyan and so on and so forth. So that's what Tosfot asks over here. If this are dvarim haniknim ba'amira, haynu eicha da'amdu b'kidshu. That's only true if they right afterwards had kiddushin, which didn't happen over here. So there was no formalized commitment here because there was no kiddushin immediately afterwards, or he says the possibility is that they had kiddushin before. This was post-kiddushin, and therefore kiddushin wouldn't help with this idea that there is a kinyan. Over here, there's no kinyan at all surrounding these negotiations, but they're captured by the kinyan of kiddushin. So Tosfot says either they didn't have kiddushin right afterwards, or they had already had the kiddushin, so it wasn't effective. The reason Tosfot is saying this is because here he wants to retract his offer in the dowry. Well, you can only do that if they hadn't formalized it in any way. His response to him, Yehuda Bar Meimar, is that you gave your word, you have to stand by your word. He doesn't say that you already had a kinyan. So Tosfot is trying to figure out why there was no kinyan over here, or why we do not have a kinyan over here. So Tosfot is explaining, either there wasn't kiddushin immediately afterwards, or kiddushin took place before, so therefore there was no formalized kinyan that surrounded this negotiation that would have made it a commitment that he couldn't have backed out of.
Rav Yemer Saba mi Rav Nachman. Rav Yemer Saba, period of Rav Nachman. Machra ktubata lebala. If a woman sells her ktubah to her husband, yesh la ktubat benin dichrin, or ain la ktubat benin dichrin, does she still have a rights to the ktubat benin dichrin, or does she not have rights to the ktubat benin dichrin? So again, we've discussed this before. In terms of the ktubah of the isha, for her to sell forward her ktubah, it's the equivalent of selling an option. The option works like this. If she predeceases her husband, the individual who bought a ktubah gets nothing because the husband inherits the ktubah and there's nothing left over. On the other hand, if the husband predeceases her, in that instance, she will get her ktubah. So what she does now is she gives a forward sale of that ktubah. She basically says, if you pay me today, when I collect on the ktubah, it will belong to you. So obviously this individual has to consider two things. One is the possibility that he'll get nothing. It's a binary option, which is depending on who passes away first, either he gets nothing, it's a zero, or he gets the payout of the ktubah. That's the first thing he has to consider. The second thing he has to consider is that he's paying for it today for something he won't get until in the future. So you have a present value calculation. Gemara recognizes this, but this is basically option pricing. And here the Gemara recognizes that people would not pay the full amount of the ktubah. They would pay what's called tovat hana'ah. They would pay a certain premium, which is an option premium, for the right to get the ktubah in the instance where the husband predeceases the wife. And based on what Tosafot said yesterday, that was a lower likelihood, because Tosafot mentioned us yesterday that in their days, the women predeceased the husbands on a regular basis. That was in all likelihood because women died regularly in childbirth, and the survival rates of women were very low because of that. And so therefore, the likelihood that she would actually get her ketubah, that her husband predeceases her, were lower. Again, you'd have to look at the actual tables, the ages of the two parties, but somebody would be willing to buy the ketubah. So instead of a third party buying the ketubah, over here the husband buys back the ketubah, which would be the same thing. The husband here could buy back the ketubah, basically granted the right that if he predeceases his wife, he won't have to pay. The estate will not have to pay a ketubah to her. It'll stay within the estate. So at a certain point, there is a value in which it's worth it for him to do this, to pay for it today, in order not to have to pay out of the estate later on. So she sold her ketubah to her husband, and now we want to know, there are rights within the ketubah. Are those rights then also abrogated by the sale of the ketubah? Or do the rights stay in place? All he bought was the monetary value of the ketubah, the payout of the ketubah. The question revolves around ketubat benin dichrin. The rab benin dichrin is the right of her children out of the estate of her husband to take their share of the estate first at the value of the ketubah. So the value of the ketubah would be granted them first. And do they still have those rights? Because when she sold the ketubah back, did she sell back just the value, or she sold back also that right of ketubat benin dichrin? That's the question that he's posing. Oh, it's there to encourage her father, you're right, but in the end, it's her right. That's why the Gemara calls it, by the way, that the daughter inherits, because it's the daughter's. Amalei Rova, v'tibayalach mochelet. He says, why did you phrase the question in a manner that talks about selling the ketubah back to her husband? Why don't you talk about a case where she simply forgives the ketubah? She waives her right to be mekabel the ketubah, or as we saw before by Rabbi Yehuda, she writes a shofar that says, I collected on my ketubah already. She basically says, it's over, I don't need my ketubah. She's mochelet on it. So the Tosafot over here says, v'nira l'ri, the faresh davalach the minkat, bayatech mochelet tishchiach tfei. He says, it's just a more common case that a wife's going to forgive her ketubah than sell her ketubah back to her husband. And therefore, why don't you pose the question in a manner that is the more normal scenario? He says, I'm like, hashta mocheret kamibayle. I'm asking from a case of sale, Da'afagav de'ikala meymar, because there you have a possibility of saying, Zuze ansua, she was under pressure for money, she needed money, and because of that necessity, she sold her ketubah to raise the money, she had no other means of raising money, so she sold her ketubah to do that. Daminan kamandaka machile mea ukle be'ukla, because it's the equivalent when a person is in desperate needs, or finds himself in desperate straits for money. It's the equivalent of being beaten by a whip with a metal tip to it. I mean, some sort of really painful physical pressure. So she was under that duress, and that's why she sold her ketubah. Mochelet mi baye? If I know the answer to that question by mocheret, then I don't need to ask about mochelet. A mochelet, she's under no pressure to sell her ketubah, and yet she still does it willingly. If you tell me by mocheret, if you tell me when she sells her ketubah that she loses her ketubah benin dichrin, then al-chad kama kalvachomer, if she's mochelet, that she loses her ketubah b'din dechrin because she wasn't under duress to sell. So when she's under duress, you could argue. In that case, maybe she just sold it for the money, but everything else, the other rights remain in place. By mochelet, there's no argument like that because she sold it willingly, not in the sense of sold, but forgave it willingly. She wasn't under any duress. She didn't have to do it. She did it of her own volition. She does it of her own volition, then she really gives up her rights. Because she had a ketubah. It's a good question. Like, all she's done is freedom of the obligations in the end.
And that's what the Rif says. In this case, she just forgave the rights that would belong to the Yorshim, but retained the core ketubah that related to herself. Or, the other possibility discussed by the Rif and other Rishonim, is that she was only mochelet on the Tosefet HaKetubah, not on the core ketubah. So as far as having a ketubah for marriage, she still has the maneh or matayim, and that's why it's still a ketubah, and she's not married without a ketubah. On the other hand, she's forgiving is the tosefet ketubah, and that's what's being referenced to over here. Although the Ritva over here just suggests that in Ochanami, there is a problem, but that's not the Gemara's discussion. The Gemara's discussion here is about the monetary obligations and which rights were forgiven or waived in this case. It's not asking about the relationship between the woman and the man and whether they can stay married. That's a separate issue which the Gemara is not discussing over here.
It does defeat some of the purpose of a ketubah to prevent him from willy-nilly divorcing her. It's not a great idea. Amar Rabba, pshitali, Rabba says, all right, well, let me lay out what I think in terms of the different scenarios here. Mocheret ketubah tala achirim. She sells her ketubah to third parties. Yesh la ketubah benin dichrin. She for sure still has the rights of ketubah benin dichrin. My time up. What's the reasoning? Zuze and Suat. The only reason she sold her ketubah to a third party is because she's under duress for the money. There's no reason for her to sell her ketubah to another party unless she really wants to monetize it today. And the only reason she wants to monetize her ketubah today is because she needs the money. So for whatever reason, she was under duress for that money. And because of that, she sold her ketubah. So when she sold it, we say that she only sold it for the monetization of the payments, but the ketubah bedin dichrin remains in place. And she didn't intend to give up that right. Mochelet ktubata lebala, ein la ktubat benin dichrin. If she forgives the ktubah for her husband, then she's basically undermined the ktubah in that sense. She's not only forgiven the monetary payments, she's forgiven her rights in the ktubah. And that includes the ktubat benin dichrin, because there she's under no duress. The fact that she is quote unquote mizalzel in her ktubah, to the point that she's willing to be mochelet, in that case, we say that she's basically given up her rights because she did it all of her own volition. My taima, achule yechilta. She forgave everything. She was willing to give up the ktubah from her children. She was willing to do this without any remuneration. So that's a serious question as to why she's being mochelet on her ktubah. I mean, she might like her husband a lot, but there's no reason for her to do that because she's only a loser in this case. There is no benefit in this case to her and no benefit to her children. The fact that she went ahead and did it anyway shows you that she's not really considering so much about her ktubah. So in that case, we say she's mochelet on everything. But, by Rova, the one question is this third case, where mocheret ktubata lebala, when she sells the ktubah to her husband, how do we view that? Kumocheret le'acherim dami? Is it the equivalent of selling it out to a third party? Or is it the equivalent of being mochelet for her husband? Boter de baya, other pashto. After he presented the question, he answered it. Mocheret ktubah lebala, kumocheret acherim dami. Selling her ktubah to her husband is the equivalent of selling it to a third party, and therefore the ktubat benin dichrin will remain in place and still be there. Again, here she is getting remuneration for the selling of the ktubah, which indicates that she wasn't willing just to give up her ktubah. She found herself under some pressure to get the money, and therefore she's trying to monetize it today, or get some money out of it today. And for that reason, she did it, but she wouldn't have otherwise done it. She's not just willy-nilly throwing away her ktubah, or being mochelet in her ktubah, and therefore she retains the other rights that are associated with her ktubah, including the ktubat benin dichrin, which is that the male children will inherit or take precedence in the inheritance of their father up to the value of the ktubah. Okay, meiti ravidi bavin. Meita. In a case where she passes away, in yoshim shel zeh, v'in yoshim shel zeh, yoshim ktubata. Neither of her inheritors, her children, will inherit her ktubah. So remember this, this is from the Gemara, it's a Mishnah in Yevamot. The Mishnah in Yevamot talks about a case in which a woman gets information that her husband has passed away. Based on that information, she goes in and she marries another individual. And then, lo and behold, her husband shows up. In that case, the Mishnah says that she has to get divorced from the first husband, she has to get divorced from the second husband. And the children from the first husband and second husband are deemed mamzerim. All these other things we penalize her with. Again, the Chazal said they did that because they wanted to be makil by the guards to an aguna, but they had to give a disincentive from using that or playing around with that. So they made the back end very severe, that if you're wrong, there's severe penalties to it. But if you utilize it in the right way, then that's fine. We'll be making allow an eid echad, even people that are not kosher le'edim, to help you out in the cases of a guna. So one of the things that comes out in that Mishnah is that the case where she passes away, in yoshim shel zeh, in yoshim zeh, ktubah ta, neither one of the parties inherit her ktubah, va'avinan ba. And we asked over there, ktubah ta, ma'avite. Why is she getting a ktubah? Again, we discussed this yesterday. In instances where dissolution of the marriage is her fault, then she's not entitled to a ktubah. Over here, the reason that the marriage is being dissolved is because she went ahead and married another man before knowing for certain that her husband had passed away. So in that instance, when she loses the ketubah from both parties, it's her fault, and therefore there is no ketubah. So why are you talking about her children, her inheritors, inheriting her ketubah? There is no ketubah to inherit. So if I'm a rab, papa, it must be ketubat b'dinin dichrin. It's talking about ketubat b'dinin dichrin. It's not talking about getting the ketubah. It's talking about the rights of her children to be given within the Yerusha of their father precedence with regards to the value of her ketubah. So vamai, why is it the case that her children lose out on the rights of ketubat b'dinin dichrin from both sides? I mean, both children from the first husband and children from the second husband, they do not have that. So when it says, Achanami lema yetzer anso, why don't we say over there the same thing that we say over here? When she sells her ketubah, the reason that we say that the ketubah b'dinin dichrin stays in place is because the only reason she sold her ketubah was she was under duress. She was under financial duress, and that forced her to sell her ketubah. So we say she sells the monetary side of the ketubah, but the rights of ketubah b'dinin dichrin stay in place. Say the same thing over here. The reason she went ahead and married this other husband is because yetzer anso. She was compelled by her desire to be married, to have companionship, and that drove her to go get married to this other individual. So she did it, quote-unquote, under duress. If that's the case, why should she forfeit the rights to ketubat b'dinin dichrin? It says, hatam knosahu dekansua rabbonon. The reason is because it's in a list of items in that Mishnah that are all penalties. These aren't items that normally would be the outcome in these situations. These are punitive things that we're doing to the woman. We're penalizing her so that she acts properly in the front end. So this is another one of those penalties that even though technically the ketubat b'dinin dichrin should have stayed in place, nevertheless, we say that it's wiped out in order to incentivize her again to make the right decision in the front end. And it is simply a penalty. But otherwise, yes, you're right. The ketubat b'dinin dichrin should stay in place when there's some other duress that's causing her to sell her ketubah or to lose her ketubah. Yotiv, Rabin Bar Chanina, Kamei de Rav Chista. So Rabin Bar Chanina was sitting in front of Chista, V'yotiv V'kamar Mishmei de Rabbi Elazar. And then he was quoting in the name of Rabbi Elazar, Mochelet ketubata labala, en la mizonot. A woman who forgives her ketubah to her husband, she's no longer entitled to mizonot. So another one of the tnayei ketubah is that a woman is entitled to mizonot, sustenance, both in the lifetime of her husband, as well as after the death of her husband, she has the right to be sustained out of the estate of the husband, as long as she doesn't collect her ketubah. Again, we saw in the Mishnah whose right that is to make that decision, whether it's the Yatomim's right or her right to make that decision. But she is entitled to mizonot. So now what Rabbi Lozer is proposing is that when the woman is mochelet ketubata, not only is she forgiven the monetary obligation of the payments of the ketubah, not only she lost the ketubat b'dinin dichrin, she's also now forfeited her right to collect on mizonot. Amalei, ilav dekamartli mishmei degaver rabo. Had you not quoted this in the name of Rabbi Elazar, havamin alocha, I would have said a different outcome. Meaning that if you left it up to me, logically, what should happen in this case, I would not have come to the same conclusion. But because you said in the name of Rabbi Elazar, I'll accept it because he's a gaver rabo, Rabbi Elazar, Talmid Chaver, Rabbi Yochanan in Eretz Yisrael. So since you quoted it in his name, I'm going to be bound by it. But otherwise, I would have said, Meshiv ra'ah tachat tovah, lo tamush ra'ah mi beito. A person who, in exchange for good, does bad, no bad should ever leave his house. I mean, that's evil. Someone who does you a tovah, somebody is generous towards you, and in return, you do something terrible towards them, they should be penalized with only bad the rest of their lives. That's just not a way to act. So over here, the woman forgave the ketubah. She did something that was generous and beneficial to her husband. So now what are you going to say? That the husband now doesn't have to pay her mizonot? That seems to be that he's repaying her goodness, her generosity in forgiving him with a ra'ah that he's not giving her mizonot. So had you left it up to logic, I would have said that out of her generosity for forgiving the ketubah, he should continue to sustain her. That's the right way to be in these situations. That's the right way to act. But now that you told me that Rabbi Elazar says that, I really can't argue. That wouldn't have been my first thought. But now that you said it, I'm bound by that memra. Yotiv, Rav Nachman, Ve'ula, Vav Yimei Bar Rav Papi. So you have these three individuals sitting. Yotiv Rav Chia Bar Ami Gabayu. Rav Chia Bar Abba was also sitting with them. The Rabbeinu Tam points out, not here, but in other places, that anytime you have a list of individuals who are sitting together, Here you have four individuals who are all sitting together. There's no reason to delineate Rav Chiya Bar Ami separately. Why does it delineate him separately? All four of them were together. It says, oh, the three of them were sitting, and he was sitting with them. So that means that all four of them were sitting together. Whenever the Gemara does that, Rabbeinu Tam says you should anticipate the person that they delineated is going to say something that's a chiddush in the next part of the Gemara. So Gemara delineates that individual to mark the fact that this individual is not going to say something of significance. Keep your eye on that individual. Atahu gavra, deshchiva arusato. An individual shows up whose fiance passed away. He was engaged halachically to this woman and she passed away. Amrile. So they said to him, zil kavar, take your choice. Either go bury her, ohavla ktubata, or give her her ktuba. We had seen earlier in the Masechta that the exchange for ktubata is kburata. That the husband inherits the ktuba. Over there it meant the nedunya, that he inherits the dowry. So in exchange for inheriting the dowry, he buries his wife. That was the quid pro quo in that case. And therefore, in anticipation of the fact that the husband will inherit that dowry in the end, if his wife predeceases him, he's obligated to bury her. Again, we saw in the Gemara Yevamot that, in a sense, she becomes like a mate mitzvah in that situation because the relatives will not bury her because they're not inheriting her. They're not getting him the money. And there's a huge expenditure involved in the burial. And since he's inheriting her, we obligate him to take care of the woman in that instance. So Amar Lahu Rav Chiya. So as we expect over here, who pops up is Rav Chiya. Here's what they told him, and Rav Chiya is challenging them, because he was the one who was delineated separately. So now he comes up and says, Tanina, we have a Mishnah. Ishto Arusa. Individuals engaged halachically. Lo Onein, Velo Mitamila. First of all, he does not become an Onein. He doesn't take on the status of Onein. That has relevance with regards to eating Kodashim. So he's not an Onein when this woman passes away. Velo Mitamila, if he's a Kohen, he's not mitame himself for her. A Kohen is mitame himself for the Shiva Krovim, the seven relatives that he has a right, and even according to Rambam, an obligation to become tame. We force him to come tame for these seven relatives. One of those relatives is his wife, because it says Sheiro. So Gemara Dashan's Sheiro Zoishto. The Sheiro is his wife, and therefore he becomes tame for his wife. But over here, since she is not a full-fledged wife, they're only engaged halachically, therefore, he doesn't have a right to become tamei for her. V'chein hi, with regards to her position, lo onenet, she does not become an onenet. Again, this has significance in terms of eating kodashim and other statuses of being an onen. V'lo mitamelo, and she cannot become tamei for him. Now, this is a difficult statement because women do not have a requirement of not becoming tamei. Even a kohenet has no obligation to remain Torah. She can become Tameah, she can be go to a funeral, she can come in contact to a mate. So you have one of two options over here. Rashi quotes one option over here, which is, we don't compel her to become Tameh. She's not obligated to become Tameh in this case. If she chooses to, that's fine. But we don't obligate her to become Tameh. This is somewhat along the lines of the Rambam. The Rambam, who says this about a Kohen, is that we compel Kohanim to come to Tameh for their close relatives. Because he says it's an achzariyut. It's a certain amount of lack of feeling and proper behavior when a person does not mourn and take care of those that have passed away. And so if a Kohen says, I'm too holy, I'm too kadosh for that, we compel him to come to Tameh and say, you've got the wrong idea here. You're not acting like a ben adam. You have to act like a human being. Forget about being a messenger of God and being kadosh. The basic requirement, this is what the Ramban says on the Torah, civility, ben adam l'chaveiro, is the foundation for any ben adam l'makom. If you're lacking in ben adam l'chaveiro, you can't be doing any ben adam l'makom. So here, the Kohen who's a messenger of God, he's kadosh, that kedusha is premised on acting properly. And acting properly is having feelings, mourning for an individual passed away, taking care of them, becoming tameh mate. So the same thing over here. This woman, we're not going to compel her because she's not really married to him. If she so chooses, she has the right to do it. In the Gemara in Yevamot, when they quote this, Tosafot brings another possibility, which is, it was lifnei haregel. It was before the regel, where there is possibly, according to some Rishonim, an obligation to be mitayer oneself before the regel. And therefore, this woman may not become tamei, because if she becomes tamei now, she'll be concluded. For instance, now, if she became tamei today, she'll be precluded from doing the Korban HaPesach. So we don't want that to happen, so therefore we actually allow her not to become tamei. If it's one of the seven relatives, she would have to become Tameh. She would be compelled. But Eni Metamel over here, there's an obligation not to become Tameh because of the Kodeshim that are involved over here. Meita, Enu Yorsha. If she passes away, he does not inherit her. Meitu, if he dies, Gova, Tubata. He collects her in Tuba. So you see over here that there's an inequality here in the sense that if she dies, Enu Yorsha. He does not inherit her ktubah. He does not inherit the dowry, the nidunya that was put into the ktubah. On the other hand, meitu, if he dies, govek ktubata. She has a right to get her ktubah. She gets a right to get paid out on the ktubah. The manema taim, which is the core ktubah, plus the tosefet, the addition that the husband brought in. So there's an inequality over here, which is that she has a right to inherit the ktubah. On the other hand, he has no rights of inheritance over here. So what Rav Chanina is pointing out to them is you're saying he has to bury her because they are saying either bury her or give the ketubah back. Rav Chanina says he wasn't entitled to the ketubah. He didn't have any right to be yoresh the ketubah. He doesn't get that when she dies, meita inu yorsha. He doesn't inherit the dowry. So why are you saying to him that he has to bury her because either give back the ketubah or bury her? He doesn't have rights to the ketubah, so then you can't compel him to bury her. Time of the meitu. That's only because he died. Ha metahi. But if she dies, ain la ktubah. So again, the indication is that if she dies, not only is he not yoresh to her, she also is not entitled to her ktubah. So if she's not entitled to her ktubah, then he shouldn't have to have an obligation to bury her. As Rashi says, it's not that there's a ktubah. If she dies, there's no ktubah to collect. Because the ktubah is collected when he predeceases her. If she dies, then there's no ktubah to collect. So what does it mean, ain la ktubah? Is that ain la din ktubah. She doesn't have a din ktubah, and din ktubah is that she gets kfurata, tachet ktubata. So that doesn't exist over there. My taima. What's the reasoning? Amar Rav Hoshaya, shein ani koreba, likishiti nasi lacher. When you marry someone else, titli masher katuv laichi, that you will collect that which belongs to you. So the right to collecting a ktubah has to do with her ability to marry another party. That's what's written in the ktubah. When you marry with someone else, then the estate will pay you out the ktubah. I mean that if you stay in the estate, you're entitled to mizonot. If you leave the estate and go out to marry another party, you're entitled to your ktubah. That means that the entitlement of ktubah is premised on her ability to marry someone else. Over here, she obviously can't marry someone else because she passed away. So therefore, there is no ktubah over here. Since there is no ktubah over here, there's also no kvura. So therefore, based on this, you have different components over here that we have to understand. In terms of a ktubah, the ktubah has involved, in terms of what the woman has in the ktubah, she has the rights to the maneh mataim, she has the rights to the 100 and 200 zuz, depending if she's a betulah or an amanah, and then she also has rights to the tosefet ha-ktubah. The husband has a right to inherit the dowry piece of the ktubah, and not have to pay the ktubah that he would owe her if he had died first. So the woman's right is to collect her ktubah, which is the 100 or 200 zuz plus the tosefet ktubah, plus the dowry, obviously, that she would get back through the ktubah. That would be what she collects. On the other hand, the husband, if she passes away, he gets to keep the dowry and not have to pay out the obligations that would be involved if he had passed away first. So the Gemara says, brings a mishnah, basically that Rabbi Chiya quotes that we've seen before, which is that in the case where she's an arusa, the husband does not inherit the dowry. He doesn't inherit the dowry. Since he doesn't inherit the dowry, we would have thought, okay, no go in terms of the kvura. That's number one. Number two is, what about the fact that she does not collect on her ktubah? So that's what the Gemara was midayek out of the Mishnah. It says, meitu, if he dies, govek ktubata. She collects the ktubah. Time of the meitu. That's only because he died. Ha meitahi. If she dies, ain la ktubah. She doesn't have any rights of ktubah. She has no din ktubah. So why is that? So that's what's explained here by Rav Hoshaya. Rav Hoshaya explains that, how would I have viewed ktubah? If I view ktubah that she has a right to the 100 and 200 zuz, plus the tosefet, and now when she dies, basically, he got his money back. Is that the way we view it? Or do we view it as if he never had to pay out the money because she died first? When she predeceases him, basically, he is now forgiven of that need or necessity to pay the ktubah. What happened? Did he actually have, like, money in escrow that was out there? I mean, not in reality, but is that how we think about it? And then when she dies, he got his money back. So in that case, you would say that she actually got her ketubah, and he got his money back, and he inherited a ketubah in a sense. If he did that, then he should have to bury her. On the other hand, if we view the ketubah being paid out only triggered when he dies, then when she passes away, isn't he that gets his ketubah or doesn't have to make that payment? He never made the expenditure to her that he got it back. It basically was his, and it remained his. That means that she gave him nothing. Since she gave him nothing, now he's not obligated in the kvura. So if you look again at the component pieces, as far as the dowry is concerned, he doesn't inherit that, because it's only an arusa. So that's out of the picture in terms of him inheriting her. Oh, maybe he inherits her ketubah, which is the obligation to pay her the 100 and 200 zuz plus the tosefet. Maybe he inherited that, and that should obligate him to the kvura. The answer is that he didn't inherit that. He never had to pay it. He was never obligated to pay it. If he never obligated to pay it, it was his, and it remained his. That means he got nothing from her. If he got nothing from her, then there's no obligation for him to bury her. And that's what the Gemara's answer is. The Maitama of Oshaya is, since she never collected her ketubah, he never got it back. If he never got it back, he didn't get anything from her. If he didn't get anything from her, he's not obligated in her kvura. And that's what Rashi says. The last line of Rashi, Hilka, kol zman shelo meit, as long as he doesn't die, v'lo nitgarsha, and he didn't divorce her, lo nishtabe ba, he is not obligated to pay the ketubah. V'lo yoresh mena kolom, and therefore he's not getting anything back. When she predeceases him, he didn't get anything back because he never expended anything. There's no Yerusha for him over here. If that's the case, then we can't obligate him to bury her. So again, in a case where it passes Nisuin, and once you cross over Nisuin, he inherits the dowry. In that case, he's obligated in the kvura because he'll inherit the dowry. So forget about the other part of the ketubah. The dowry itself will obligate him now to bury her. But here in the case of Arusa versus Nisuin, where he does not get the dowry, so that couldn't be the compelling reason to make him bury her. What do they say? The kor ketubah should compel him to bury her. The kor ketubah, in the end, the Gemara says, is not hers to give to him so that he has to bury her. There's nothing that he got that forces him to bury her. And therefore, the conclusion is, based on Rabbi Chia bringing the Mishnah, as well as Rabbi Oshaya's explanation of it, is that he does not, or he's not obligated to bury her, unlike what they had told this individual to do, either give back the ketubah or bury her. Kiata Rabin, Amar Reish Lakish, when Rabin came from Eretz Yisrael, he brought a memra from Reish Lakish from Eretz Yisrael, Arusa Shemeita in la ketubah. And Arusa that passes away, she doesn't get a ketubah, but she doesn't get a ketubah, she passed away. So in la ketubah means in la din ketubah. She doesn't have a din ketubah, which means her husband's not obligated to bury her. Amar lo Abaye, Zilu Amar le. So Abaye in Bavel says to tell Rabin, take that great thing that you did for us and throw it on the thorns. Rabbi Oshaya already told us or explained to us this information in Bavel. Ravin brings the name of Rabbi Shlokish, so he's bringing a member of Eretz Yisrael. So he thinks he's bringing us something new, new news, new information, a member from Shlokish in Eretz Yisrael. So what Abaye says to him is, take back all the credit that he wants to get for bringing this memra, because Rabbi Oshaya already explained it. Rabbi Oshaya lives in Bavel. Rabbi Oshaya explained to us why this is the din, and he told us this is the din. So we didn't need the memra from Eretz Yisrael. We already had it in Bavel, and therefore Ravin shouldn't pat himself on the back. He can throw that memra back out on the thorns, meaning that there's no reason to give him credit for bringing us the memra when we already had the memra ourselves. So Tosfot over here points out that it's interesting. Rabbi Oshaya's explanation here says that we darshan the ketubah, that we look at the wording of the ketubah, which is Lashon of the Chachamim instituted there, and we're Doresh, what we think should happen. Tosfot says that that's the Shita of Beit Shammai, not the Shita of Beit Hillel. How come we're following the Shita of Beit Shammai? So in the end, Tosfot says something interesting. He says, all the Tanaim, and we have many pieces of evidence through our Mishnayot here, as well as other Mishnayot and Shas, that we are Doresh Lashon Hejot, that we look at contracts, and we look at the wording of the contract. We look at the ketubah, we look at the wording of the ketubah, and based on that, we will make halachic decisions about what should be the rights and what should be the outcome. It says, therefore, since so many Tanaim hold like Beit Shammai, in the end, halacha is like Beit Shammai here, that we are Doresh, the ketubah. In the end, he says, maybe even Beit Hillel agrees to that, and they change their mind. There is a discussion that we had earlier that Tosafot discusses whether Beit Hillel really reversed their position and agreed with Beit Shammai, or they were compelled for a different reason to agree with Beit Shammai. Tosafot Shita there, as well as over here, is that Beit Hillel did not change their view that we don't darshan the ketubah, and they got it out of a kal v'chomer. In the end, he says, maybe they did agree in the end. Maybe they did change their mind. Maybe we're not Dorish it so carefully, but we are Dorish to Ketubah, and even maybe Beit Hillel agrees to it. So he's trying to come up with a reason why halachically we're going to follow this position, even though it seemingly is the position of Beit Shammai. And now we continue with the Gemara. Benan nukvan de'avin leicheminai. Female children that are born from me, they're entitled to gain mizonot and nedunya and parnasa from the estate until they get married. So that's what's written in the Ketubah. Rav Tani ad tilakachan leguvrin. Rav says that the Ketubah contained this language, that they're entitled to this until they get married. Ve'levi tani ad tivagran. And Levi wrote until they age out. Until they're a bogeret. So after they reach the age of bogeret, where they're on their own, then they're no longer entitled to take out of the estate. The Rav, afagav de bagar, the Levi, afagav de insiv. Wait, so for Rav, even if she becomes a bogeret, she's still entitled to the estate because she didn't get married. And for Levi, if she gets married, she's still entitled to take from the estate because she didn't reach the age of bogeret. Doesn't seem like they're mutually exclusive. Ella, bagar, velo insiv. If she came of age and didn't get married, in sivlo bagar, or she got married and did not become of age, kuliyama lo plige, nobody disagrees that she's out of the estate. So if she has nisuin, she's clearly out of the estate. If she reaches the age of bogeret, she's clearly out of the estate, she's no longer entitled to take money. Ki plige ba'arusa velo bagar. The question they have is in a case where she has yet to age out, she's under the age of bogeret, but she's engaged halachically, she is an arusa. V'chein tani Levi b'matnite, and Levi has this in his brightot, the brightot that Levi was misader, adeti vagran, v'yamte zimneon in sevin, until the time that they age out, they become a bugaret, v'yamte zimneon, and their time to get married comes. Gemara says, tarte, what do you mean? What, you need both things? She needs to both be a bugaret and get married in order to be thrown out of the estate? Hello, oti vagran, o yamte zimneon it asba. So that's what Levi says, and that's what we had said, suggested before, that this is his position, that otiv agran, or they come of age, or their time to get married has come. What that means, that the time to get married is that they are arusot, and then the 12 months has elapsed since they were in arusa, or the 30 days has elapsed for an amana. In that case, that's the time to get married. And so at that point, they are locked out of the estate. So what Levi suggests over here is that nisuin is the trigger for pushing them out of the estate, not a rusin. On the other hand, Rav says, ad tilakachan leguvrin. Once you're taken, the word likicha is synonym for kiddushin. From the time of being an arusa, she's already pulled out of the estate, as opposed to Levi, who says only a nisua is pulled out of the estate. And that is their machloket. Their machloket is whether Irusin takes them out of the estate. Levi says no. Rav says yes. Ki Tanae, the Gemara says, is similar to another machloket Tanaim that we say, ad matay abat nizonit. Until when does the girl granted the right to be sustained out of the estate? Ad sheti ares, until she gets engaged halachically. Bishum Rabbi Elazar amru, ad sheti vager, until she comes of age. Tani Rav Yosef, ad dihavyan, until she has a havaya. Ibai Eloho, Havaya de Irusin, or Havaya de Nisuin. When Rav Yosef says means Ad de Havaya until there's Havaya, which one is it? Is that the Havaya engagement is what triggers that? Oh, Havaya de Nisuin is Havaya, that of getting fully married, consummated marriage. The word in the Torah, it says, Valcha v'ayta li'ishacher. She will go and be with another man. So v'ayta is the word Havaya. That's what the Gemara darshins. V'ayta is Havaya. Itkish kol havayot adadi. All of the havayot, meaning all the ways that she could enter to be together with her man, are connected. There the Gemara's darshin is kiddushin. But the word havaya is used in the Torah to be a description of the woman joining together with a man. So the question is, that havaya that he's describing here, is that the joining through erusin? Or is that the joining through nisuin? Teiku. The Gemara leaves that as an unresolved issue. They don't know which way that Rav Yosef meant that. But based on that, you can see here that there's a machloket as to when is the trigger. The Tanakhama clearly says, ad shetiares. Nerusin is the cutoff. The way that Rav Yosef has it is havaya. Now, it depends how you understand havaya. Havaya could either be like erusin, and therefore it's the same as the Tanakhama. Or if you have the lashon of havayan mean nisuin, then you have a machloket here between whether it's an arusa or a nisua that triggers her being excluded from taking sustenance out of the estate. Amar lei Rav Chista to Rav Yosef. So Rav Chista asked Rav Yosef, Mishmelacha mine de Rav Yehuda? Did you hear about this from Yehuda? Arusha yesh la mizonot? Oh, ain la mizonot. Did you hear from Rabbi Yehuda whether an Arusha is entitled to mizonot or not? Amar lei Mishma lo Shmeli. I never had that misora. I never knew about it. Ela misvara leitla. On the other hand, logically, I don't think that she's entitled to it. Kevan de Yersa, lo nechale de titzel. Because once she becomes an Arusa, the husband has a vested interest in seeing that this woman is not denigrated in any way. The reason that we provide mizonot out of the estate for the girls is we don't want the girls going around and panhandling, knocking on doors to collect money. Because it's not dignified for a woman to be going around in that manner. So therefore we say we'd rather have the boys going around doing that and leave the girls to be sustained out of the estate. Or, even if there's sufficient funds, we don't want the girls to have to go get mizonot, so we sustain them out of the estate. At this point, she's already engaged. So now, if we don't give her mizonot out of the estate, and then she'd have to go around and collect food, you know who's going to step in here? The husband is going to step in. He doesn't want his arusa to have to go around and collect food door to door, so he'll step in and provide her mizonot. So we were afraid there'd be nobody to provide her mizonot, so the estate provides her mizonot. In this case, we have a backup. We have the husband. So therefore, we don't provide her mizonot at the estate because we have another party that will do it. Amalei, im mishma lo shmielecha, misvara itlo? He says, if you didn't hear it, then misvara, she should have it. Since he doesn't know her well enough, he doesn't know whether he's going to actually get the nisuin, because it's erusin now. He might find a woman or he might find something wrong with her over this period of time. And that would undermine the erusin. He'll never consummate. He'll never have a nisuin. So he's not going to throw money at his arusab. He's not certain he's actually going to marry this girl. So there, I would have said the opposite. That's what Rav Chista is suggesting back to Rav Yosef. He said, if you're arguing from logic, I would argue the logic the other way around, which is the arus is not going to step in here because he's not going to throw his money at an arus, so he's not sure he's going to marry an in. V'kadamre, that it went just the other way. Amalei mishma lo shmieli, I never heard anything in the name of Yehuda. Misvara idlo, but I think logically, she's entitled to it. Kevin delo kimle begava lo shadi zuzibichte. Since he doesn't know whether he's actually going to finish off the marriage, he doesn't know her well enough, he's not going to throw his money out to support her. So Amalei, Rav Chista responded to him, I mishma lo shmielecha misvara leitlo. Says, if you didn't hear anything, I think the logic dictates just the opposite. Kevin de irsa lo nechale de tidzil. Now that he's engaged to her, he doesn't want his fiance to be denigrated in any way, and he'll step in to support her if the estate doesn't support her because he wants to make sure he's marrying a woman of stature, a woman who has not have to go around and collect her panhandle, and therefore he will step into the breach. So you have the two lishonot over here. In one case, Rav Yosef presents the logic, and then Rav Chista gives the opposite logic, and then in the Ikadami, it's just reversed who presented each case over here. But because of that, you actually have a logic to both sides. You have a logic why she should continue to get out of the estate, because the Arus is not going to step in here because he doesn't know her well enough to know if he'll actually marry her. Or you have a logic that should say we should step out. She shouldn't get from the estate anymore, because the Arus will fill the breach, because he doesn't want his fiance to be denigrated in any way. So the logic would have dictated in both directions, and therefore we have to come up with a misora of some sort that tells us which way to go. And as Tosfos points out, lo shmiele plukta de tanae leel. He obviously didn't hear about the machloket tanaim that we brought before. Inami shmiele umibayle heche ochota. Or he did hear about Rav Chista, but he didn't know which way the halacha went, and that's why he posed the question to Rav Yosef. But in the end, we don't have an answer to the question, which is, which way should it go? Because you'll need a shmur, you'll need to know which way the halacha goes, and that the Gemara did not resolve at this point in time.
Now, we explained that version in the conversation between Rav Chista and Rav Yosef, according to Rashi, who just says this is a continuation of the previous Gemara, and asking the same question as we had asked before, which is, what is the threshold point at which the woman is no longer allowed to take mizonot out of the estate? The Rif, on the other hand, sees the machloket over here not relating to the same question that we raised above, but rather in a situation where this woman got engaged, and then at the time of Nisuin, which is the 12 months later, her Arus passes away, and therefore does not ever give her mizonot. Question in the Gemara here is whether we would trigger the necessity out of the estate of the Arus to pay mizonot to this woman, even though normally an Arus would have no obligation in paying mizonot, Maybe in this case, because she crossed over the threshold where he should have started to give her mizonot, therefore the estate is obligated to take care of her and pay her mizonot. Or maybe we say since she never got mizonot from him, he never had nisuin with her, she is not granted that right of mizonot. And that is the question according to the shita of the Rif. There is a third shita amongst the Rishonim, which many of the Rishonim follow, which is, the question here is according to Rav. Rav who says that Erusin is the cutoff. Once she has Erusin, she's bumped out of the estate. In this case, what is the din of the Arus? Normally, the Arus has no obligation vis-a-vis his Arusa. But in this case where she's a Yatoma because her father passed away, and she's going to get bumped out of the estate, how do we view the Arus's obligation in that instance? Do we say then he is obligated to pick up the tab for her because he's the one causing her to lose the ability to get mizonot? Or do we say no, that the Arus is no more obligated to pick up her tab than the estate is, and therefore he's not obligated until he reaches the point of nisuin? So based on the fact that she will lose for sure the mizonot, lefi shitat Rav, the Gemara here is discussing Rav Yosef Rav Chista as to whether the Arus then has to pick up the tab at that point in time or not. Now the Gemara continues, Bamine Rav Sheshet. Rav Sheshet asked this question, Mima enet yesh la mizonot, ein la mizonot. Does a Mima enet entitled to mizonot or not entitled to mizonot? So in this instance, a Mima enet is a girl whose father had passed away, so she is a Yitoma, and she's taking sustenance, mizonot, out of the estate. Her brother or mother marries her off midrabanan. She has a right, because it's only kiddushin nisuin midrabanan, to be mamanet. She can annul that marriage. When she annuls that marriage, the question is, can she then come back and collect mizonot from the estate? The question revolves around this issue, which is the way that girushin work, if she was to get divorced, then the nisuim existed, and the divorce is prospectively releases her from the husband. On the other hand, the way that miyun works, the annulment works, is that it actually undermines the marriage completely. So how do we view this girl? Do we view her as being a nisua, that she had been married, and therefore she's now left the estate and she can no longer come back? Or do we say that her annulment actually undermined retroactively the entire nisuin, as if she never left the estate, and therefore she's allowed to return for mizonot? So they said to Rav Sheshet, Tinitua. We have this in a braita. Almana bebeit avia, vigrusha bebeit avia, vishomeret yavam bebeit avia. If you have a widow who goes back to her father's house, a grusha divorcee that goes back to her father's house, or a shomeret yavam that goes back to her father's house. Rashi claims in this case, it's all cases of erusin. This woman was an arusa, and that erusin was terminated, and now she returns to her father's house. Because if she was a nisua, there'd be no question, according to Rashi. Once she becomes a nisua, she's completely out of the estate, and she has no right to return to her father's house in order to collect from the estate mizonot. So that's why in all of these cases, yesh la mizonot, is because she only reached the point of erusin. And since it was only erusin, she never fully left the auspices of her father's house. And because of that, when she is released from that, she returns to her father's house to collect mizonot. The Rabbeinu Tam has a different shita here, which suggests that these women, even if they were nisuot, even if they were fully married, and then either divorced, widowed, or following Shomeret Yavam, they can return to the father's house in order to collect mizonot. Tosfot himself says that he thinks that the Rabbeinu Tam shita does not work well here, and it doesn't make sense, and therefore he upholds Rashi's explanation here that we're speaking about a case of erusin. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Oda bebeit avia, yesh la mizonot. She still remains in her father's house. She's entitled to mizonot. Ain't a bevet avia. She's not in her father's house. Ain't la mizonot. She has no mizonot. So Gemara says, Rabbi Yehuda, I know Taina Kama. Rabbi Yehuda is not saying anything different than the Taina Kama. What is their argument? Elalab mimeenet igabeinayu. Their machloket must revolve around this mimeenet. That Rabbi Yehuda views the mimeenet as leaving her father's house. She reached the point of nisuin. And since she reached the point of nisuin, she's not allowed to return to Beit Avia in order to collect mizonot, despite the fact that she has miyun that undermines the nisuin retroactively. She still was in nisua. On the other hand, the Tana Kama says, well, she's back in Beit Avia. Once she's mimanet, it's as if she never left. So even though she was yotze mi Beit Avia, even though she left her father's house, now she's in her father's house because she annulled the marriage retroactively, and therefore she's entitled to mizonot. The Tana Kama savar itlo. The Tana Kama believes that the mimanet is entitled to mizonot, even though she's left her father's house. Rabbi Yehuda savar leitlo. On the other hand, Rabbi Yehuda believes that she's not entitled to it because she reached the point of nisuin. Nisuin, in any other case, would take the woman out of the estate and not allow her to return. Almana min ha'erusin. Telling us that an almana min erusin is entitled to mizonot, but an almana min nisuin is not. But it also comes to maybe preclude a case or include a case of a mema'enet that is nisua. So it's only the almana who is not entitled when she gets to the point of nisuin. But a mema'enet, when she reaches the point of nisuin, according to the Tanagama, is still entitled to mizonot, because she annulled the marriage retroactively. Bat Yivama, a daughter of a Yivama. So the original husband passed away, and now the brother who performed Yibum with this woman has a daughter from their levirate marriage. What is the din of that daughter? Yesh la mizonot, o ein la mizonot. Is she entitled to mizonot, or is she not entitled to mizonot? Tosfot says, why doesn't the Gemara ask about a Yivama herself? Is the Yivama entitled to mizonot or not entitled to mizonot? So Tosfot says the Gemara knew for sure that the Yivama was entitled to mizonot out of the estate of the husband, because the way that it's structured is that we know this from Mishnayot and Yivamot, that either she gets her ketubah out of her original husband's possessions. If he doesn't have possessions, then we move the lien of her ketubah onto the second husband's possessions. And since mizonot or tanei ketubah, she'll be entitled in the same manner. She'll get either mizonot out of her original husband's possessions, and if there's not sufficient there, she'll get out of her second husband's, the levirate marriages, mizonot. The question here is this bat, this daughter that is born, how do we reflect on her? She is a daughter that was born of this levirate marriage, but based on a union to the original husband. And the original husband was the one who promised that the female children will be entitled to mizonot. So is she entitled to mizonot because of the first marriage? If he has possessions, it would seem simple that she definitely gets mizonot out of the first husband's possessions. Question here is, if he doesn't have possessions, is she entitled to that out of the second husband, the levirate marriage's possessions, to get that mizonot? Because he never really had a ketubah with this woman, because he got her through his brother. So maybe he never made a commitment to the children born to this woman that he would take care of them. Yesh la mizonot, o ein la mizonot. Is she entitled to mizonot? Kevin damar mar ketubatal nechsei bala rishon. Since the mother's ketubah references back or has a lien on the original husband's possessions, leitla, therefore she has no entitlement from the second husband's possessions to collect mizonot. Odoma came in to eat leitla mirishon. Had the first husband not had sufficient possessions, takinu l'rabana misheni, therefore the ketubah would move over to the second husband's possessions. So that means too that this daughter should also be granted the right of mizonot through the second husband's estate. So therefore eitla, she would get them. Teku, the Gemara leaves this unresolved as to whether the bat of a Yivama born from that levirate marriage would be entitled to mizonot out of the second husband's estate if there were not sufficient means in the first estate. Tosfot does bring a second possibility that even in a case where first husband has possessions, that this question exists. Because the first ketubah that was written by the original husband says, my female children I will support. This daughter was not born to him. So therefore, he does not have to support her. So we know for sure, even if the first husband has possessions, she will not get entitlement from that. The question is, does she get entitlement out of the second husband's possessions because he performed the levirate marriage? She's a daughter born to him. Do we say that because she's his daughter, there's an obligation? Or do we say that this individual never had a ketubah with this woman that guaranteed the daughter's mizonot? So does she get out of the levirate marriage's estate because she was born to him? And if there were not sufficient funds out of the first husband's estate, she would get out here? Or do we say that the second husband has no responsibility vis-a-vis this girl because this whole marriage came to him through his brother, and therefore she's not entitled to mizonot? Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots at the bottom of Nun Gimel Amud Bet.